From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum in the hour ahead, as part of our ongoing series, In My Experience, we turn our attention to people who make their living working with the dead. Not to put too morbid a point on it, but what is it like to work with the dead, and what effect does it have on one's view toward life? We'll take all that more up in the hour ahead. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. As part of our In My Experience series, we're going to talk this hour with people who work with the dead for a living. We have a crematorium director with us, a woman who specializes in at-home funerals, and a student who dissects cadavers, all joining us for the hour to share their stories and talk about really how working with the dead has changed their own views on life. And let me introduce them to you. Jerry Grace Lyons is here, and she is executive director of Final Passages. They're a nonprofit. They focus on at-home funerals and green burials. We'll find out about those. She's assisted with at-home burials for 17 years and calls herself an at-home funeral midwife. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Michael.
Lucas Freshman, also with us in studio, graduate student, even despite his name, who teaches a human anatomy class with cadavers at San Francisco State University and is all about dissection. And thank you for being here, Lucas Freshman.
Thank you for having me.
We also have David Arnold, who's stuck in traffic, but will be here shortly, I'm told, a crematory grounds manager at Santa Rosa Memorial Park. He's worked there since 1994. Jerry Grace, let me begin with you, because I think it's safe to say that you're kind of a pioneer in this movement of home funeral movement or death midwife or whatever we call it. You know, we had home births and still do, and now we have home burials. It started, it was kind of a Santa Rosa-centric program here today. It started with a friend of yours in Santa Rosa, and what possessed you, so to speak, to do this?
Well, it was that friend's death. She was a nurse, and she worked in a person's home taking care of her, an older woman. And one morning she went to work, wasn't feeling well after they had breakfast. They called 911. They came as quickly as they could, and they were unable to resuscitate her. She died at age 56, and she did have a history of asthma, and that was possibly the contributor.
Was there a request to have a home burial?
Yeah, that was the surprise too. On top of the shock of her death, we learned that she had left her final wishes written out. And those instructions that she had given to her close friend in San Francisco stated that she didn't want to be turned over to a funeral home. She wanted to be brought home if she died at a hospital and taken care of by her friends. That is, have her body washed and dressed and anointed with some oils and have ceremony in her home.
Gardenias, I think, too, right? Songs and stories and gardenias and flowers.
Oh, yes.
And
that
all.
Was, I mean, she wrote out requests. All of the yeah. specific yeah. things, yes.
And so you went about, you know, body bag, futon, van, the whole works, and washing the body and all that.
All of it.
Yeah. I mean, we have such a kind of verboten attitude toward death and dealing with the dying. I mean, a lot of people don't want to get near them, don't even want to look in the casket when the opportunity is there. But this was something that that mattered to this woman who was your friend, and therefore you mm-hmm. took it upon yourself and did it. But what a lot of people don't realize is it's pretty ancient.
It's everybody around the world has taken care of the dead, and many people around the world still do. In this country, we've kind of gone to sleep about that. We've forgotten that it's our heritage. It's actually the tradition of this country for people to do that. And we're just helping people learn, reclaim this or restore this way of caring for our own, for those who want to take it on.
A lot of them are home birthers and homeschoolers, I imagine. Huh? I mean,
a lot of them are. Yeah. Take charge kind of people, people who like to do things their own way.
And we're talking about a process generally, you have to have dry ice to preserve the body. This can take 4 to 6 days.
Well, the average time people keep someone at home is 3 days. That's true around the world in different traditions and religions. 3 days is very common.
How did this become a calling for you? Because that's obviously what it is.
It is a calling. And that experience with my friend Carolyn was so profound for me. I had an awakening, and I was very moved by the experience and wondered, it helped us through the shock of her sudden death. A group of us were doing this together, and it made the whole process more gentle and was very transformative for us. And then I started questioning
why. Excuse me, transformative how or in what ways?
Well, I didn't know it was possible either. You know, I didn't know it was legal that you could do it that way. I also moved through, I'd say, waves of emotions, going in and out of deep grief and sometimes feeling upset and angry that we didn't get a chance to say goodbye to our dear friend, and then feeling extremely joyful. Of feeling this sense of love surrounding all of us. I mean, the whole room filled with love. And we would feel a sense of joy and even think that it was Carolyn's humor and joy coming through. I felt direct communication from her. I kept getting the words, go back to her house, continue on. All my appointments fell away magically. And so I continued on through the whole experience. So it took me away from my deep fears about death and made me feel like death isn't so scary after all. It's
diminished the anxiety and the verboten quality of death.
All
and
of those.
Made it more, what, human, more connected to life?
Connected. We all felt connected as a group going through this and connected with Carolyn and the experience. It just pulled us right through and creating the ritual of sitting around her body, singing, reading her poetry. We remained connected through all of that. And it opened our hearts like nothing ever could have.
You're speaking really quite lyrically and beautifully about this. I know that there are probably people who are thinking, this is weird, you know. this is really out there.
Yes.
And you say what, though, to that attitude?
Well, I guess I felt that way, too, that like most Americans feel that death is optional. And I really didn't think a lot about it, although I had had one experience prior, a couple of experiences, one when my father died, and I didn't get to see him through that. In fact, we were all asked to leave the room in the hospital when they were going to disconnect him from the machines, but also a friend who died when I was in my 30s, and she was also a close friend. And her husband did keep her at home and have a wake for her. And I think that was the first seed that was really planted. I saw how peaceful it looked.
Our guest is Jerry Grace Lyons, Executive Director of Final Passages. David Arnold is crematory grounds manager at Santa Rosa Memorial. Park. He's going to be with us later in the hour. But Lucas Freshman is here in studio, and he's a graduate student who teaches a human anatomy class with cadavers. First of all, why are you in this work, Lucas? Why do you do it?
Initially, I was a student of this class about two and a half years ago. Needless to say, the class was amazing to me. It really opened my eyes. It was one of the more intense classes I've ever taken.
You said needless to say, but some would say, why did it open your eyes? Why is that needless to say?
I think that it's not your typical science class. It's not your typical class. There's a very direct application of what you're learning right then and there. The other amazing part for me, I think, would be the intensity of it. I had never seen a dead body before. I had never been around an amazing collection of specimens and skeletons and other and other kind of bones. So it was a very real class. Sometimes I feel in some parts of school, you go through some motions. You are given kind of a set of steps to follow. But this class for me was very real, very, as I said, intense.
But you know, many people would avoid wanting to. I mean, you have some enthusiasm, but many people would avoid being even in that situation. There's a thing called memento mori, you know, where you look at a skeleton like poor Yorick. I knew him well in Hamlet, and you say, that makes me think of death, and I don't want to think of death. I don't want to be morbid about it. But, you know, it sounds like it's given you sort of something close to a thrill to be there.
I would say thrill. I'd be careful to not sound too weird about it, as you were saying before. But I definitely admit to a thrill. Maybe because death is kept so far from our view and from, and I would say true death. Maybe movie death is not the real thing. So when we're exposed to something that we're kind of kept from, that definitely produces a thrill, I would say. I think the other interesting part to me was that it was sort of a look into myself as well. You know, I obviously that wasn't me that we were examining, but in a way, it's the exact same thing. You know, biologically speaking and physically speaking, that's the same thing that I'm made of. So, an investigation into that body is sort of an investigation into me as well.
And you do a lot of that anatomical investigation in the dissecting work you do, as I understand it. There's a recognition also of how mechanical our bodies are when you're dealing with dead people. Most of these are older people who are donated. I mean, the cadavers are donated. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Mostly like over 70 of age. And
That would be correct, too. I think over 70 is a good average average age for the cadavers that we get. We get all of our cadavers from the UCSF World Body Program. And as far as I understand, it's similar to, you know, how you sign the back of your driver's license saying that you're an organ donor, except you're donating your entire person to study. So they come from UCSF. We get them, and then we just begin the dissection from basically start to finish.
And this is to learn anatomy. This is an educational process, basically.
Yes. The students that I teach generally are all on their way to becoming something in the medical profession. So physical therapy, doctors, nurses, dentists occasionally. In the 6 semesters that I've taught, I think we've had one true artist who was just doing it to learn about the body. But generally, it's for medical professionals. And the anatomy class is a prerequisite class in order to go on to those different schools or those different educations. So pretty much everyone who wants to eventually be a doctor or a nurse, et cetera, must do an anatomy class.
You get about 4 cadavers a month, I understand.
That's correct. We have, 4 new – oh, not a month, a semester.
I mean a semester,
yeah. Four new cadavers every semester. So that includes 2 or 3 that we keep in the lab as well, just to kind of show the difference, just to show the before and after, basically. So in any given time, there could be 6 to 7 cadavers in our laboratory, as well as about 13 skeletons, human skeletons, and a number of other specimens, bones, et cetera, et cetera.
So how does this affect your view? I mean, you're a young man. You, one would hope, have many years ahead of you and so forth. How does this affect your view of life?
Well, one thing that I've thought about semi-frequently when doing the anatomy class or teaching it is that it kind of seeing bodies this way really equalizes everybody. You look past superficial differences, obviously, when you're getting past the skin, and you start to see how really everybody is the same, you know, with, you know, some obvious pathological exceptions. You know, this person has a certain disease and this person has a certain, you know, medical history. But essentially, we're all the same kind of parts. So the physical realization of that we're all basically made of the same stuff kind of transfers over into, you know, how you deal with people who are alive, I would say. You know, whatever our differences or similarities or superficial things, I kind of know that basically we are the same stuff at some point.
So you see a kind of universal connection to other human beings. Do these classes ruin appetites?
It's common for some of the students to look kind of green and you know, but in sort of an educational way, there are some parts of the body that you can relate visually to food. So it's a strange part of teaching the class, but it's sort of in a way I can get the point across.
Actually, I think didn't you say that your favorite system is a digestive system or something like that? We just saw Mary Roach out here, and she's written a new book called Gulp, you know, which is all about the digestive system. But incidentally, let me open the phone lines. We're talking as part of our In My Experience series with people who work with the dead for a living, and we'll be talking shortly with a crematorium director. And you can join us if you have some thoughts about this. And I suppose what I'd like to hear are some thoughts about well, not only this kind of work and what it brings to your mind, obviously there are people who have to do it, and many people who find it very rewarding work and work that they're passionate about and work that matters to them. In fact, Jerry Grace Lyons and David Arnold work with a lot of grieving people and people who are certainly bereaved. But also like to hear maybe some thoughts about, well, life and death and just mortality, because I think when we think about the Grim Reaper or the Big Sleep or I don't know, whatever you want to call it, we often think about life as being inseparable from it. I don't want to get too philosophical nor too morbid here, but I know many of you have some reflections. You may want to join our conversation, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your thoughts and your questions or comments. 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments or anything you'd like to contribute to the conversation right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. This is called In My Experience. Some of you in your own experiences may indeed have dealt with, in one facet or another, the deceased, and may have some thoughts, again, that you want to contribute here. You can also go to our Facebook page. We welcome comments and questions there, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum. Jerry Grace Lyons said before maybe we'd find out what a green burial is. What is a green burial?
A green burial is what people might think of as earth-friendly. Means no embalming to the body. There's no grave liner or vault put into the ground, made out of cement or plastic these days. The casket's either biodegradable or there is no casket. The person's just wrapped in shroud and placed directly in the ground, the way probably it was always done, or people were put in a pine box. So that's and ideally it would be done in a park setting so that perhaps you're in amongst trees. And no gravestones, but rather maybe an indigenous plant or tree is planted there.
Very environmental.
It is.
And David Arnold has just joined us, crematory grounds manager at Santa Rosa Memorial Park. Worked there since 1994. I keep getting notices from the Neptune Society. I think they want to do their work on me, or they think maybe I'm ready. David, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. And you help facilitate cremations. You also do traditional burials and dig graves. I mean, you're around dead people a lot.
Yes, sir. Quite so.
So let's talk about, we've talked about the effect on people who do this kind of work. What's the effect been on you overall?
Well, I made a career change some 20 years ago from public service and dealing with the public on a service-related industry to my current position at Santa Rosa Memorial Park. Initially, it was quite a change because it was a career change at that point in time. Certainly, it took some time through the first months or so to adjust to what I was doing, and that was to help facilitate final disposition for those families who wished cremation in their deceased life or deceased passing. It's become a very important job to me because of what I do to serve our families that come to us for those types of arrangements. I feel very comfortable in what I do now. The adjustments have been made over 20 years. I think that's probably pretty much like putting my pants on each morning.
Well, you had also done a couple of tours in Vietnam, as I understand.
I have, sir. Yes,
and we're in the car service industry, so you know you've been around the horn in a lot of stuff. But at this point, we're talking about cremating people, and I mean, just one of the things I think that needs to be put out there is it's a lot less costly to cremate.
I think that's one of the prime reasons that that families are seeking cremation as the final disposition is because of economy. Certainly the cost of cremation is much, much less than what traditional burial is at this point in time. I, as a traditionalist, wanted traditional burial until I became involved in this industry and found out that it is a dignified means of disposition. And the costs that are saved by those families, particularly those who are regimented by cost each day, it's become very important to, in our industry to service those families as equally as they would a traditional burial.
They go into essentially average temperatures about 1,700, 1,750 degrees?
That's average, yes. It's dictated by the size of the deceased, but that's generally about what I operate at.
And we're also talking about bringing it down sort of to powder, aren't we, in the final analysis?
In the course of the cremation, the deceased arrives to us in a combustible container, generally a cardboard box of sorts. The cremation from start to finish of actual cremation takes approximately 2 to 2.5 hours. And what is remaining as far as the cremation is concerned is the calcified bone material from the deceased's body. At that point in time, once it's cooled sufficiently, I remove it to take it to a large processing unit, and that brings the cremated remains, the bone material, down to a flour-like consistency.
And you had to cremate your own brother.
I did.
Yeah. Talk about that.
Skip, Ernest Little, my half-brother actually, passed as a result of cancer some 7 years ago. We were very, very close, had been for all the years that we had been together. It was emotional, very emotional for me at that time, but having been introduced to my co-panelist, Jerry Lyons, and serving some of her families, it became, as I thought about the relationship from deceased to living, it became easier for me to deal with. It was certainly a task, but nonetheless something that I was destined to do or actually asked to do because of that. And Skip asked me to take care of him when that time came.
You have, I don't know, clients, customers, what the right word is here. I want to be graceful about the use of language, but many of them are Hindus because they, of course, believe in cremation.
That is certainly so, yes.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out more about our three guests and the work they do and their attitudes toward life, and we'll hear from you. And again, we want to find out if you've seen or worked with dead bodies or even sat with a dead body after the person has passed, and whether you work at a post-mortem profession or have other experiences to share, we'd certainly like to hear from you. Again, you can call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. We'll return and hear from you when we do. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and as part of our In My Experience series, we are talking with people who work with the dead for a living. With us in studio is Lucas Freshman. He's a graduate student who teaches a human anatomy class with cadavers at San Francisco State. And David Arnold here in studio is a crematory grounds manager at Santa Rosa's Memorial Park. He's worked there since 1994. And Jerry Grace Lyons, an executive director of Final Passages, a nonprofit that focuses on at-home funerals and green burials. She's assisted with at-home burials for 17 years and calls herself a home funeral midwife. And here's some comments about, well, a lot of comments from listeners. Let me just read a few of them. This is a listener, Monica, who writes, When I was 27, my college sweetheart and husband died of a very rare cancer. The one glimmer of beauty in the horror and the sadness of the experience was he was lucky enough to die at home, surrounded by family, without doctors and nurses. After he took his last breath and we knew he was gone, we cut off his hydration tubes and moved his body off of the rented hospital bed and onto a fresh bed with clean, crisp sheets. We washed his body and placed flowers from the garden all over him. It was an instinctual desire to wash him and cover him with flowers. I had never experienced death and didn't know this was a traditional custom in many cultures. I just felt an intense urge to wash him and cover him in beauty. We kept his body at our home for 2 days until everyone who was traveling to say goodbye could see him, and then we had him cremated. 6 months later, I took his ashes to Baja, where we used to spend our winter breaks, and I kayaked out over his favorite reef and watched them sink into the sea. I'm now 40 years old. I have two beautiful children and a loving husband and a happy life, but this experience has never left me, and it is an integral part of who I am. I think about him every day, and I know I will for the rest of my life. Another listener writes, I had a friend whose parents ran a funeral home in Wyoming. As a child, kids would tease her about this. She shared that her father used to console her and tell her, it's not them, the dead, we have to fear, it's the living. As an aside, having lived in the Azores, it's commonplace to have the body at home. There's more normalcy about this cycle of life. Seems like we have a lot of existential denial in our culture. And Kim writes, I don't work with the dead, but I watched my husband die and was with his body for a while before he was taken from our home, and that one experience has changed me and my relationship with life and death and made me realize how connected the two really are. I'm not afraid of dying now, because when you're dead, you're free of this world. I'm more afraid of dying at the wrong moment. And another listener, Margaret, says, we should do what the Tibetan and Parsi cultures do, share the dead body with the vultures. The body is hacked into pieces by the Tibetans out in the open where the vultures are eager and hungry. The Parsi place the dead in open towers and leave them to the vultures. How sensible. It's a method of composting, returning the remains to nature's recycling and restoration. Surely beats putting the dead in gorgeous coffins with brass handles, further reducing the planet's forests. And Ken writes, interesting show for a gloomy topic. My family and I were present when my father-in-law passed away at home, my first time observing a person moving on. At first, I assumed we'd be asked to leave the room for privacy, but we stayed. A person's last moments were moving, to say the least. One of the most profound and wonderful private events in my life. I hope to leave the same way. David Arnold, you had an experience I'd like listeners to know about. Somebody's hand moving, head moving? What was it?
That was my first, I won't use the word traumatic, but it was scary. I had been employed by the cemetery and the crematory for approximately 1 month at this period. I was being trained as to how to operate the equipment facilitating cremations. And the gentleman who training me in the equipment, there was little portholes that you could look through to view the ignition of the case to see if everything was working properly. And this gentleman training me was observing a cremation in process, suggested I come over and look. He indicated that, look, Mrs. Jones is waving goodbye. Well, as I saw this, I actually saw an arm moving back and forth in a waving motion, and it frightened me actually initially, and then I understood probably right away that the combustible material, the body being aflame, suggests that tendons and muscles contract and what have you, and this is in fact what was occurring.
You sure she wasn't waving goodbye?
Well, I'm certain she was alive doing that.
And what about the lady with the locket?
Locket. Oh, who has become a very good friend of mine, a client of ours. Her mother passed some years ago, and oftentimes families like to take cremated remains and place them in a locket, a ring, whatever device that they can wear upon their body. And I did this for her. I took a small portion of cremated remains, placed them in a locket, and sent her on her way. Just days later, she returned to tell me that the locket had fallen from her chain and come open, and the cremated remains had scattered about the floor or wherever it had occurred, and was in hysterics about what to do. Having taken the bulk of the cremated remains home with her along with the locket, I just simply took some more, placed it in the locket, resealed it, and gave it back to her. Well, she since has had no more problems with that episode, but has become a very close friend and visits frequently just to say hello.
You know, there are a lot of, parodies and lampooning of the whole industry. I mean, I think about Jessica Mitford's book, you know, American Way to Die, but I'm also thinking about Evelyn Waugh and a few other movies like that. And there does tend to be, I mean, first of all, you have to be very personal. You both. I'm talking about Jerry Grace and David Lucas. In your case, you don't have to be that personal, except for maybe your students. But I mean, because you're dealing with people who are bereaved, and you have to be empathic and all that. And yet, in many respects, there is often a kind of, call it dark humor or gallows humor in your work, isn't there?
Well, sure. I mean, you have to keep a sense of humor about it. We're all going to die. So, I mean, you can have a doom and gloom attitude, or you can see the humor in it, like the arm waving, as David mentioned. I mean, we see that. I once had helped a family whose the son discovered his dad laying on a bed, and he had died with his arms above his head. And we had to call a coroner because he wasn't diagnosed with a terminal illness. So the coroner came over many hours later, and they were trying to put his arms down at his side to put him on the stretcher to take him out of the house. And they did massage one arm, and some of the rigor mortis had relaxed out of the body, which it does. Most people don't know that, but after so many hours, it does. But the other arm was too stiff, and they couldn't get it to move down to his side, so they left it where it was, put him on the stretcher. And as they were walking out, it looked as though he was waving goodbye with one arm above his head. And so there was that bit of humor that he left his family with, and they all saw it and they laughed, you know. So, I mean, they were, of course, very sad that he had died, but we see that many times. Sometimes one eye will open a little bit when the person's died, or, you know, it just seems to pop open a little bit. And a lot of people have made comments about them winking or not wanting to miss anything.
Yeah, what could be more fun? Huck Finn got to see his own funeral, you know. they thought he was dead, and it's a boyhood dream. Let me go to your calls here. And we begin, Grant, with you. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I'm calling from Sunnyvale, and I have had kidney disease for a long time. I got sick when I was 15 and had one transplant kidney from UCLA, a second one from UCLA, and now that I've had transplants, I can't give back to the community either blood or tissue. So I have willed my body to UCSF as a teaching tool to help other people learn how to be doctors, etc. So that's pretty much why I'm calling.
Well, we thank you for the call. And needless to say, when we turn to you, Lucas Freshman, you could use more cadavers in terms of the pedagogical process of the work that you do.
True, true. And I'd have to say that it's interesting listening to the caller and connecting a potential cadaver. That was an interesting experience just right then. But nonetheless, one thing that I emphasize to all the students is how important a gift it is when people decide to give their bodies to science or to education.
Or their organs, of course.
Or their organs, yeah. As well. Sure.
But you need these bodies. You need them in med school. You need them, you know, in so many different professions.
True. And another thing that we always emphasize, too, is that these cadavers are these students' first patients. So they need to, you know, treat them as they would treat, you know, a potential patient they will have down the road. So treat them with respect, humility, you know, use all their skills, all their education, and get the most out of what they can.
That's an ethos that I imagine you all have. I mean, you treat the dead with respect.
Oh, absolutely. It is. They have as much. They should have as much respect in death as they do in life.
And we'll bring more of our callers on. We'll go to Kate next. Kate, join us.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
All right. Yeah. I called in to say that the first time I got involved with dead bodies was when I was a sophomore in college. I had a summer job working at Cleveland Clinic and was working in the pathology department. Down there, I ended up helping the doctors who were doing autopsies, eventually being able to cut open the bodies by myself, find what I thought were the most likely problem areas so that when the doctor would come down, I could just present them to him or her and say, I see this, 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 and this. And it was a fascinating experience. one person, a dead person, whom I remembered particularly was a black man in his early 40s who had died of a heart attack. And he, you know, he was muscular in every way. All of his internal organs were in great shape except for his poor heart, which had just gotten wiped out by atherosclerosis. And it made me aware of how just one part of us can do in the whole system.
Yeah, I think Lucas Freshman, that must be apparent to you a lot of the times, too.
I agree very much. Although we do mostly have older cadavers, but we do know the cause of death of all the bodies that we work with, and we can see for sure how that particular part led to some other, you know, pathology or other disease in other parts, and we can kind of, you know, we solve the mystery of this person's death or life in a way. Seeing one part in relation to the whole is a very interesting part.
And Kate, we thank you for the call. I want to get another caller on, and that's Heather. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. And I just wanted to say I've taken two of Jerry Grace's courses, and they really helped me when my uncle died. I was able to be with his body with my cousins until the coroner came and picked him up, and I felt like I was able to watch the whole process, and I felt I was able to be present and kind of just watch the whole thing and see him out, you know, his final exit in kind of a respectful way.
So what are you teaching, Jerry Lynn? Teaching courses in home burial? Or?
I am teaching a series of courses called Honoring Life's Final Passage. Uh-huh. And we talk about everything from the approach to dying, conscious dying, and making our plans, talking about fears and concerns about death, really trying to prepare the way. And then what happens at the time of death, right on through to the care of the body after death, different traditions. We discover taking care of ourselves around this work if we're helping families or our own family. So it's all those things, how to help somebody across in not a medical model, but just practical things we can do.
And Heather, thank you for that call. And again, Jerry Grace Lyons is Executive Director of Final Passages. And our next caller is Susan. Good morning.
Hi. Hey, I'm an RN, and I just wanted to say that I had great reverence for the woman, the cadaver that I was privileged to work on in my training, and it meant a lot to me. I've never forgotten her. And I also wanted to say that my children were quite young when my mother passed away, and I brought them to the funeral, and they offered a new perspective to everyone who was there. They were little girls at the time. They explained that that was not their grandma when they looked at her in the casket, that she was gone, that they would help carry her out to the gravesite. And it was very refreshing, I think, for everyone to see the circle of life and have them there. My brother, on the other hand, said it wasn't appropriate to bring the children. He wanted to keep them away. So I think that opens up a real discussion among families.
Well, we thank you for that call. In fact, David Arnold, you mentioned how difficult it was to cremate your own brother, but also cremating children, you've had to do that too.
There is oftentimes where a child, unborn infants, come to us for cremation. I have an awful lot of empathy for the families of those children. One is that the child has not lived any life yet, and the family is suffering the loss of a child. I can't imagine what that would be as far as the loss of your child is concerned. That still tends to be tedious for me in regards to what I do. I just have this hopeful feeling that the family and that child will somehow be reunited.
How much in the work that each of you do, how much does your own belief or faith connect to the work you do, or does it? And maybe you don't have faith. If I could just get you on record here, Jerry Grace.
Well, I do feel that...
Let me just ask you, right, you believe in an afterlife?
Yes.
Okay. So...
I do. So it does absolutely connect me with what's going on. I feel it's a spiritual experience and that I'm eclectic and I appreciate all religions, all cultures, and the various ceremonies and rituals that people do. I appreciate them. I feel it's rich. It's enriched my life. But also I have seen and had direct experience with things, phenomena that tells me that there is more to this life than what we see and feel and hear in this dimension.
Is that true for you, David Arnold? Do you believe in a soul and all that?
I too believe in a supreme being. I belong to the Independent Order of Odd Fellows, and that's one of the first questions that are asked of any potential member. Do you believe in a supreme being? And having dealt with all types of religions and seeing the approaches that are taken to our industry and how they believe and accept death and get through the process is very interesting to me, and I've gained great respect for religion in that respect.
Lucas, you don't have to answer this. I mean, not considering the work you do is very different, but what are your thoughts on these matters?
Well, I definitely think that kind of coming at this topic from a sort of scientific perspective, I do think that understanding the body gives you great insight into understanding the soul. I'm not sure if understanding in any meaningful way, but at least recognizing that there is such a thing. And what I mean by that is sort of what I was saying earlier is that you start to understand all bodies, all people are basically made of the same stuff, and thus that connects you.
Stardust, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
That's what I mean.
Let me get another caller here. Eric, join us. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Michael, so my father was in medical school in the 50s here in San Francisco, and apparently after anatomy class, they would sometimes have, you know, quote-unquote parties with the cadaver still in the room, and I don't know how far this is, you know, stretched, but that they would put the chips and dip near the bodies and put sunglasses on them, and I think the whole thing was to really sort of desensitize them. And I don't know whether there's any comments on that, but...
Well, I can tell you there are a lot of stories about medical school students and cadavers, yeah, some of which cannot be told on the air.
It creeped us out, but anyway, I thought that was, apropos to the conversation here.
Well, I'm glad you contributed that, and I thank you. Anybody want to comment?
I would comment. Soon after the cremation of my half-brother, and he was placed in a wooden urn that he had built, actually, I took him home on the evening after the cremation, sat him at the dinner table, and had dinner with him.
Well, here's some listeners emailing. Lee writes, it's a Mormon custom to gather the extended family's children around the open casket the day before the funeral and have the kids view, even touch if they wish, the corpse. Then an adult family member has the kids sit around the casket and gives them the glove speech. The adults hold up a gloved hand, describes how our body is like the soul's glove, then pulls the glove off. I'm sorry, I'm thinking about my perverse mind, thinking about the O.J. Simpson trial. You know, if it doesn't fit, you can't acquit with a glove. But this is actually, I guess, a Mormon custom. Then, like the corpse, it's lifeless. The speech ends with telling the kids how the person isn't there, just the glove left behind. I've seen this done. It's very effective, helping small children deal with their loss. And P.S., don't forget to mention Evelyn Waugh's fine comic tragic novel, The Loved One, and Samuel Beckett's great comment that the day you die is like any other day, only shorter. Here's Adele who writes, I recently assisted my mother and uncle in burial arrangements. My aunt, the uncle's significant other, was very distraught and she couldn't find her camera. When I inquired, she let me know she wanted to take pictures. This is a familiar practice in her family, not at all in ours. What are some of the differing practices witnessed in this very private and intimate ritual? Well, you've dealt with so many different cultures. You want to talk about what comes to mind here, either of you?
The Hindu religions, and there's many different sects of that religion, I have seen in their – they often want to witness the placement of the deceased in the cremation chamber, and prior to that they go through their ritual. And no two are alike. Sometimes monks will accompany them their priest on one occasion, and this one is most memorable, is that of the entourage that was in our crematory at the time of this cremation, there were approximately 15 to 18 individuals, family members and friends, that the monk took a ball of string, attached it to the deceased hands, and through his hands passed that ball of string through every other person in attendance. And they sang their rituals, they prayed, they did what they had to do, and then the ball of string was wound up and placed into the casket with the deceased and cremated with him. And my understanding is that each and every person that had held that string left something with the deceased so he could carry on to wherever it is that they go.
Mm. Jerry Grace, any special rituals?
Well, actually, a very similar one. I often use yarn and pass it around similarly. And people will speak things that connected them, stories about the deceased. And they might be lying, what we say, lying in honor or lying in grace in the casket right in the middle of all of them. And so they'll speak some beautiful memories or words that describe them and connect everybody. And then each person will cut the yarn with scissors and tie the yarn on their wrist. And they take these home with them in memory of the person and often will wear it until it just literally falls off.
Yes. Yeah. Read some more of our listener comments before I go to more calls. Twee writes, curious comment, I was always intrigued by how colleagues in the healthcare industry were so respectful of the occasional corpse. There was this whole solemnity about prepping a body for the morgue, but these same colleagues could be pretty harsh to living patients who were different, the morbidly obese 35-year-old female patient, the psych patient who thought hospital staff were aliens, the black pimp patient with two amputated legs who was in for dialysis. It almost seemed like the more respectful individual staff members behaved toward a corpse, the more likely they were to bully odd patients and underlings. It would be funny if it weren't plain sad. Ed writes, Mr. Krasny, don't forget to mention how Dickens humorously drew the character of Jerry Cruncher, the resurrectionist, in his novel Tale of Two Cities. In those days, medical students had to provide their own cadavers for study, so bodies were stolen fresh out of graves the night after burial and sold to these students. The sellers were called resurrectionists by Dickens. Actually, it reminds me of when I was in Cuba, we went to a graveyard, and, you know, for all kinds of practices, cadavers were stolen, bones were stolen out of the ground. Another listener writes, I'm curious, do your guests ever look at people, and they have guards, in fact, guests ever look at people and imagine how they'll look after they die? Does working with dead bodies change how they view living bodies?
Lucas, I think that's yours.
Go ahead.
It definitely changes. I mean, I don't think it's not like a switch off, switch on kind of thing, but I recognize now that, you know, everybody's going to become a cadaver, or everyone will be a dead body eventually. So.
Unless we reverse the enzyme process or a singularity project, you know, there are all kinds of possibilities out there.
Yeah. So the people that, you know, that you care about and that you know, you know, in a way, I think that you start thinking that you want to make sure that they live as much life as they can. They have a very vibrant life, you know, either for fear of becoming a cadaver early or to stop the eventual process to become a cadaver, I would say, or a dead body, I should probably say more.
Erica tweets, have your guests ever watched Six Feet Under on HBO? Did any episodes resonate with them? A lot of nodding going
the
on.
The Green Burial one, for sure.
Yeah.
I saw that also.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, it was beautiful. And the woman who created that shroud that was used in the program lives right here in San Francisco.
Let's go to Richard next. Richard, join us.
Hi. I'm a member of the Hevra Kadisha in Santa Rosa, California, which is the burial society for the dead. And if the deceased wishes a burial in the Jewish graveyard, we prepare the body by removing the clothing. It's cleaned, it's washed, it's put in a burial suit of trousers, a jacket, and an over jacket, and a head covering. And then, you know, it's placed in a simple wooden casket with holes in the bottom, and that's how we send them to the next world, cleaner, and sort of we take the world off of them, you know what I'm saying? We clean underneath the fingernails. It's washed thoroughly, regardless of the condition, so that, you know, by sort of casting off this world for whatever the next will bring.
Well, since you've called, Richard, I'm looking at a listener comment here from Enrique. He says, the Jews have a funeral component where the family helps bury the deceased. It's considered the last mitzvah, and you can do for your loved one. My friend, who's a mortician, thought of his job as an avenue where he could do last favor for so many families in his community. I would venture that these jobs are not morbid but magnanimous. And I thank you for your call, web comment. And by the way, you can learn about green burials also by simply going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Please ask your guests if they have tales to tell about ghosts and hauntings while they work with dead bodies.
Oh, gosh. We have lots of families that have reported all kinds of interesting things. Mostly we see a smile on the face of the deceased. On the, say, second day of the wake, and people are just amazed and constantly saying, wow, look, they're smiling. And there's just this most peaceful look. But they also have plenty of stories about feeling their presence and many other signs that they a flower blooming at the time of year it doesn't ever bloom under their bedroom where the person had died. Those kinds of stories we hear constantly.
But you hear a lot of them, yeah.
Oh, lots.
Just a couple more comments I want to read. Chauncey writes, my mother was a nurse. She donated her body to a college. I hope that she was treated with respect. It was 3 years before I got a plastic container of ashes in the mail. It was shocking. There was no warning of when it would come, no thank you or acknowledgement of her gift from the college. I would not do that to my children. And another listener says, while the first shovels of dirt hit the casket with a somewhat despairing, resounding thud, the 15 to 30-minute process continues to allow conversation, reflection, laughter, and literal closure of the grave itself. I recommend it. Thank you all for being with us. Jerry Grace Lyons, David Arnold, Lucas Freshman. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer Amanda Stupai with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.